Hi, I'm Neil Denny, and you're about to listen to the latest of the Little Atoms Road Trip podcasts. I'm still in Oakland in California, and I've just paid a visit to the office of the science writer Mary Roach. Mary Roach is the author of a series of wonderful and funny science books, including Stiff, The Curious Life of Human Cadavers, 6 Feet Over, Adventures in the Afterlife, and Bonk, The Curious Coupling of Sex and Science. Her latest book is Packing for Mars, The Curious Science of Life in Space. And that's what we mainly talk about in this interview. So I'm talking to Mary Roach. Mary, it's a pleasure to see you again. Thanks for speaking to Little Atoms on this trip.
Oh, I'm delighted to. Great to see you.
We're going to talk in the main today about Packing for Mars, your last book. It's been out for a while now, but we haven't obviously talked about it on the show before, so that's what I want to talk about. Let's talk first of all about what drew you to this subject.
Sure. This subject, I years ago did a story for Discover magazine where I went out to Houston and I saw the Neutral Buoyancy Tank, which is this massive swimming pool, like bigger than you could ever imagine. It's not really a swimming pool. It looks like a swimming pool where the astronauts rehearse spacewalks, every little detail of it. And, just the geek in me went, wow, this is so cool. It's like Johnson Space Center was just a playground for geeks like me. And what fascinated me was just the sense of there's just so much rehearsing and behind-the-scenes stuff that goes on that is, to me, as interesting as what happens when you're in orbit. Like the preparation, particularly not just nowadays, but going back to the 50s and 60s, before anyone knew, like, what does zero gravity do to the human body and what can people even live up in space? So all the prep and the hand-wringing and the fretting and the, all the kind of stuff that has to happen first, I thought that would be an interesting book, because you typically just read about the space side of space, not the Earth part of it.
Right at the beginning of the book, you look at the... it's almost a contest rather than a rigorous selection process for the Japanese astronaut program. So perhaps we can start by looking at that. Tell me what you found there.
Oh, yeah. I went over to the Japanese Aerospace Exploration Agency when they were in the process of selecting astronauts. They had 10 finalists. It was kind of like Miss America. They had the 10 finalists. This was the talent section of it, but it wasn't the talent section. It was they had them, the 10 finalists in an isolation chamber that was kind of roughly supposed to approximate a spaceship, but it was really looking at how do these people respond over the course of a week being locked in a small space with each other, which was a fascinating aspect of space travel to begin with, but the fact that it was set in Japan added another level of fascination for me. So I was there when they had 4 or 5 like psychologists, psychiatrists in there observing them on all these cameras and as they were going about their day-to-day life, and they would give them tasks. And I didn't know what they were going to give them. And bear in mind, they're looking at what best qualifies an astronaut psychologically for a candidate for space. And they gave them this task at one point where they handed all the finalists, an envelope. They open it up, and there's these squares of colorful paper. And I look closer. I'm like, is that origami paper? And lo and behold, the contest was, in fact, it was called 1,000 Cranes, and each one of the candidates had to fold 100 cranes. And they were being watched. Not only were they being watched, but all the cranes were then strung on a string, and the string of cranes that each person did would be given to a psychologist to be examined. And they would look at, does the first crane, are the creases sloppier on the last crane versus the first crane, and how is their attention to detail holding up? And it initially seems kind of absurd for an astronaut test, but when you think about it, space requires a lot of repetitive tasks, like tightening down a string of bolts on a solar panel or whatever it is. And it's the kind of situation where you can't get sloppy and you can't really make a mistake and you really have to be focused and you have to have a tolerance for tedium. So in a way, it was kind of a brilliant task. Although initially I was like, what? They're not going to do origami. What? You're trying to picture John Glenn, folding origami.
I was particularly taken by the image of them taking their dinner plates away to examine as well after they'd finished lunch.
Yes, yes. They had these plates and dishes that all the meals would be brought in, and then they'd take them away, and unbeknownst to the candidates, each person's number would be, a little card would be placed there, and photographs were taken of each of the trays after they were done to see, Did they finish their food? Did they stack their plates neatly? You know, they're just sort of doing a Rorschach test, and not a Rorschach test. That's the wrong, I don't know what test it would be most like, but just sort of, you know, extrapolating from how your table manners and your, you know, is this person tidy, responsible adult, or are they kind of messy and they don't like to eat, childlike, they don't eat all their vegetables? And so there was just, the psychologist would then examine all these photographs of people's, the leftovers of people's dinners, which, again, not something NASA does.
So this leads us on, really, then, to the psychological implications of sending people in space. And this has always been an area of sort of deep study. People, as you mentioned earlier, and we'll start right at the beginning, we didn't even know whether or not people would be able to survive in space. Yeah. Not necessarily survive in space because they might die, but because it might send them mad. Mm-hmm, let's talk about that.
Yeah, well, initially there was just a fear that when the first people passed the boundary of where space begins, that there would be this sudden, profound disconnect from Earth, and that they would lose their mind, they would just freak out because this space is infinite and it's black, and what would happen? Can the human being even survive such a kind of a frightening and overwhelming experience? And as it turned out, they didn't even notice. The first astronauts, Alexei Leonov was the first guy to leave the capsule in space and just step out into this abyss. And there was a lot of fear, like, what's going to happen to him? You know, will he be able to even deal with it? Is it just going to completely panic him, flip him out? They couldn't get him back in. I mean, he wanted to stay. He was euphoric. Same with Ed White, the first U.S. guy to spacewalker. Ed White was just in this blissful state. They kept trying to get him to come back in. He'd been out there too long, and he was like a kid being called to dinner saying, just one more minute. I've got a great angle for a photograph here. And they're like, Ed, you've got to come back in. And hang on, just one more second. Ed, get back in here. I mean, they were worried. He had a certain amount of time he could be out there, and it was just a concern that he really had to get back in. So he did, finally, he said, as he finally acquiesced, he said, this is the saddest moment of my life. And so as it turned out, there was this euphoria instead of what there'd been a concern that astronauts would have some kind of mental breakdown, just be overwhelmed and lose their minds. But in fact, if anything, they were overly ecstatic by this feeling of floating weightless in space.
There are various things that we've thought might possibly send the astronauts mad, and another one of them is isolation, just, you know, being on your own and dislocated as well, going around the dark side of the moon or whatever, being dislocated from the side of Earth. And you talk about some experiments that have been carried out on Earth, where these things where people are put into spend 500 days living in a few rooms in a sort of biodome type thing or something.
Yes.
There's a particularly good one that you talk about, a Russian experiment that basically doesn't end particularly well.
Yeah, the Sphinx 99 test. This was a test of cross-cultural and cross-gender crews. Like, what can we learn about putting people from different cultures and backgrounds and of different genders in a small space together for a long time? And it was really fun to read about that particular experiment because on the one hand, it was for the people in that isolation chamber, it was a disaster in terms of how happy they were in their psychological well-being. There were fist fights, there was blood spattered on the wall, there were accusations of sexual harassment. The Japanese guy said the Russian guys are watching too much porn, and he quit, and the Canadian woman told on the Russian guy. So anyway, it was a horrendous experience for these poor people. But meanwhile, the psychologists were like, yes, this is what we need to know. We're learning from this. We're trying to figure out. It was pretty common sense stuff. Like, you know, you want to kind of sit people down and give them some basic information about what it's like to spend time, what the customs are like in Japan versus Russia versus Canada versus Austria. Mm-hmm. So really basic stuff, which would happen naturally if you had a Mars mission that it was going to happen like in a couple years' time, and you had people from different space agencies, different countries. Those people are going to train together for a couple of years, so all of that stuff is going to naturally come out. Things like, if a Russian man makes a pass at you on New Year's Eve at a party, just slap him across the face. If you just say no, that means yes. Little stuff like that. Like, they'll either figure it out or you tell them and you give them a little orientation. So that kind of stuff, it's important. Because those little things, like I remember talking to Ralph Harvey, who runs field camps in Antarctica. They use Antarctica as an analog for space, because it is, again, it's an isolated environment. You're not physically confined in a capsule, but you cannot leave because you'll die. You can't just wander off into the open spaces of Antarctica. So you really are stuck in this little tent camp, and very much of the time in one tent with your roommate. And he was talking about Ralph, the scientist who runs the camp, was saying he matches people up, and sometimes it's disastrous. And he had this one case where it was an American guy and a Spanish guy, and the Spanish scientist had this habit of plucking out his beard hairs and burning them in the camp stove. And it began to drive the American guy crazy. And the Spanish guy said, well, in Spain, the barbers, they burn the tips of your hair. That's what they do. And that's just something that they do. And we're all used to that. And the American guy said, but it smells horrible. It's really weird. But it's just one of those little cross-cultural differences that in a confined space over a long period of time can begin to drive you nuts.
Another thing about traveling to space is often not that well publicized is how stomach churning it is.
Yeah, the space motion sickness. This was something that was kind of kept very quiet in the early, very macho days of the American space program. The fact that basically everybody would go up and get pitifully ill. And this is why you wouldn't see spacewalks in the first couple days of a mission, because they're all curled up in the fetal position in the corner somewhere. You have to adjust your vestibular system. It completely has to kind of reinterpret cues, because what happens, you have these little calcifications, these little hard balls inside your ear, and normally when you're on Earth, when you have Earth gravity, they're down on the bottom, and if you tilt your head, they roll over one way or the other. But in space, they're floating and pinging around, so your brain is getting this message that all you did was turn your head, but your brain thinks you laid down, sat up, and the conflict between those two messages tends to do a number on you and make you nauseous. And when you come back down, you have to then readjust again. It's called Earth motion sickness. You've finally adjusted to space, and now you come back down to Earth, and everything's spinning around, and it takes a while to adjust. That's why when astronauts come down from long missions, you don't see them marching right out to a press conference. They're going to go and lie down and throw up, probably.
As often in your books, you get in and get your hands dirty yourself, and you tell us about your trip on the Vomit Comet.
Oh, the Vomit Comet, yeah. The Vomit Comet, for people who are not familiar, is a massive plane that flies this sort of roller coaster up and down pattern. It's not in space, it's just in a regular flight of a jet. And as it goes over and down, you have about 20 seconds of weightlessness, where you're basically in free fall, but since you're inside a plane, you don't feel the force of the wind, and you are, in essence, weightless. And it is either the most amazing experience of your life or the most god-awful, depending on how the motion sickness drugs worked for you. And for me, fortunately, they worked well, so I didn't get sick, but there was one poor guy. They had to sort of walk him to the back where the seats are and strap him in and give him a shot and put him to sleep. He was so sick. It tends to hit you pretty quickly. We did 30 parabolas, so that's 30 of those up and downs, where you go from weightlessness to double gravity, where you weigh twice what you normally weigh or what you are on Earth. So you're pinned to the bottom of the plane. It's this very kind of, it is a bit of a sickening sensation. You can't pick up your legs. Your head is so heavy that your neck can't really lift it. And then you're weightless, and you go back and forth and back and forth, and that does a number on you. So if you have a tendency to get motion sick and the drugs didn't work well, it's the second parabola and there's 28 more, that's a pretty miserable thing. I was pretty concerned because I'm the kind of person who gets motion sick watching a handheld movie. But I was fine, and it was just amazingly fun. It's not just the kind of, I'm floating like I'm floating in water. It's this weird, suddenly your organs inside you don't have any weight, and you're kind of liberated from this mild weight that you never really realized you were feeling. Mm-hmm. So it's this physical euphoria, and everybody's grinning unless they're very sad and throwing up. It's so comfortable. You're floating. Plus I would drop my reporter's notebook and watch it float, and the pages would fan out. I took no notes. All I wrote was "wee." I was supposed to be reporting on this team of students. They were doing a zero gravity project that they'd been in a competition, and they'd been chosen, and they got to fly, and I was the team journalist. And the team journalist is sort of like in the airspace over the experiment going "wee," every now and then bumping into them. But it was very fun, and I recommend it to anybody who has $4,000 to blow, because you can pay to go.
So you can literally
yes,
just pay.
Yes, you can.
And buy
you can pay. Not, it's not.
There must be a way
through
to
NASA. NASA. I did it through the as a member of the press with the Student Flight Opportunities Program. But there's a company called Zero Gravity Corps. I think they still exist, and they have flights out of Las Vegas, out of 3 or 4 different airports in the U.S. I'm not sure about in Europe, but you pay. I think it's between $4,000 and $5,000 for a flight, and I think you get around the same number of parabolas. Mm-hmm. So and you don't have the same kind of constricting rules. I mean, NASA's like, you have to hold the tether. you know, don't let go of that. And at the end of it, I'm like, screw it, I'm letting go of the tether. and they yelled at me, and that's okay. But it's tremendously fun.
So I want to spend some time looking at some of the various issues with zero gravity and weightlessness. I guess not least of which is floating clouds of vomit going past. But you mentioned that you were there on the plane to look at some students' experiments, and one of the sort of fascinating things to come out of the book is that, you know, everybody knows how expensive space travel is. We often wonder where all these billions of dollars are going. And one of those things is that every single component has to be tested to see how it will work in weightlessness. Why is that?
Yeah, because every machine and device here on Earth is built for Earth gravity. Take something as simple as a fuse, where you have this, you know, bit of metal that at a certain point gets hot enough that it melts away and drips away, and that breaks the flow of electricity. And so that's how it works. Well, the little molten drop doesn't drop away in zero gravity. Nothing drops. Nothing has any weight. So things have to be redesigned. The toilet is a great example. The toilet works by water flowing downward. Well, water doesn't do that in zero gravity. It floats in these sort of blobs, and it doesn't do what you need to have it do to flush things away. The toilet has to be completely redesigned. It's an airflow system. The air, like traction, just sort of pulls the material away from the body. So it's a completely, you're just sitting on a, it's basically like you're sitting on a shop vac. That's how a toilet works in zero gravity. The whole thing completely redesigned. So really, unless it's something very simple like a pair of glasses or, you know, a pencil, you know, some things do work in zero gravity. But for the most part, it has to be completely rethought and built and then tested. Like, okay, the zero gravity toilet's the size of a washing machine. You've got to test it. Make sure it's going to work in zero gravity. That means hauling it over to one of those planes we just talked about that fly in the parabolic flight. So you got to bring the toilet on there, and on top of that, yeah, that's expensive. But then you got to find some poor guy who, on command, in 20 seconds, can go. And in your number two situation, that's a challenge. And I actually talked to a guy who was on one of the flights where they were testing the zero gravity toilet. He was the food guy, and he was testing the food systems, the packaging, the little forks, and whether things were going to float away from the spoon or whatever. So he's there, but he said that the toilet people, now they had a curtain drawn, but you could see when we'd go over the top and we'd start to come down, you'd see the feet kind of like come off the ground, and then you'd hear him going, go, 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 because the guy had 20 seconds to do his business in 20 and test the toilet, and he failed.
Taking it back a step from going to the toilet in space, what about eating? How do they develop food and drink for astronauts?
Yeah, the challenges of food in space tended to be the most entertaining back in the era of the space capsules, where they were limited in terms of how much weight and how much space they had and how much weight they could carry. So the other thing limiting them, couldn't have any crumbs, which crumbs was a serious hygiene housekeeping issue, because they'd float around and they'd get in your eye, they could get in the instrument panel. That was a no-no. So they wanted stuff you could pop in your mouth in one bite instead of biting into. And the other thing they would do, they make these little tiny single bite sandwiches, very cute little beef sandwiches, coat them in this congealed fat, kind of like waxy coating, really, really revolting, stuck to the roof of your mouth. The astronauts tended to they wouldn't eat them. They'd tend to fly into space and come back down. The other thing going on in that era was, I think the thing you need to know is that there was no toilet then. There was just a fecal bag. It was a bag like that you would crap in. And that was really unpleasant and really debilitating morally, emotionally. So, not morally, in terms of morale. And so the food was designed, in fact, to constipate the astronaut. They were very highly processed, low-fiber, low-residue foods. Really unappetizing. Just kind of like the worst packaged cracker type products, and they would compress them a lot to make them smaller and bite sized. So they were really unappetizing. Nowadays there's more space. You're talking about the International Space Station or the Space Shuttle, which is roomier. You have more room for the food, and it's in bags. You can heat it up, and it's kind of food like. In fact, it's blander than most food. So there are a lot of interesting hot sauces and condiments on the International Space Station because people bring their favorite hot sauce or pesto in a tube or whatever it is to kind of spice up the food.
So the history of the space race and history of space travel is one of firsts. The first man into orbit, the first man to the moon, the first man around the moon. But we can ignore all that. I want to look at the race to be the first person to have sex in space, which we look at in the book. So you talk about something called the Three Dolphin Club.
Yes, there's a rumor on the internet that NASA had, in anticipation of people having sex in space, that NASA had spent taxpayer dollars investigating what is the best sexual position in zero gravity. And that they had furthermore actually used the neutral buoyancy tank, which I talked about at the beginning of the interview, that massive swimming pool where they dress rehearse all of their moves they do on a spacewalk. So it's this big pool. Anyway, there's this bogus experiment that was done testing, I think it was 10 different sexual positions in zero gravity and in weightlessness, because floating in water approximates floating in space. It's not exactly the same. And anyway, one of the conclusions on this bogus report was that it was helpful to have a third party to push in the right place at the right time, much as dolphins will do. So that's where the Three Dolphin Club comes from. It's a reference to people who've had sex in space, the Three Dolphin Club. Turns out, of course, this is completely bogus, false. NASA would never, in 1,000 years, spend taxpayer money on investigating the best ways to have sex in zero gravity. They may look into reproduction and conception. I mean, there may be reproductive issues that would be a legitimate focus, but not like, what's the best way to do it? You know, that's definitely not something NASA would spend its money on. And in fact, also, dolphins don't use a third party. I looked into that, and in fact, the response I got was only two dolphins are required to have sex.
But you would think that some research would be done. You mentioned before that, you know, you can pay dollars to go on one of these private trips. I mean, somebody must have had sex on one of those.
I tried very hard to find somebody who would admit to having, because I was interested not just, you're like, okay, forget space. Let's talk about zero gravity or simulated zero gravity. Those planes that go up that I talked about earlier, the Vomit Comet. Like, I just wanted to talk to somebody who'd had sex on one of those, just weightless sex. And nobody would cop to it. I called the Mile High Club. I called Zero Gravity Corporation. People do the tourist flights. They said, are you kidding me? We contract with NASA. So we don't want to get in any trouble. We want to appear very buttoned down and above board. So no, we're not. Nobody on our spacecraft has been messing around. So I could not find anyone. I even tracked down the producer of a porn film called The Uranus Experiments that claimed to have been shot on one of those zero-gravity simulators. I went so far as to download this film. When you get to the key moment, it's so obviously fake because the woman's ponytail is hanging down her back, her breasts are not as buoyant as they would be in zero gravity. It's obviously fake. It's not shot in zero gravity. The guy completely lied to me. So I could not find anybody who would cop to having had sex in space or sex in a zero gravity simulator, which is kind of astounding to me. I would imagine that there was a married couple that flew on the shuttle and they don't talk about it, but my guess is if you were a newlywed couple and you're up in zero gravity, come on.
You would.
Come on. Yeah. I would be, it would make me sad to learn that they in fact hadn't done it.
Well, if we stay with that hypothetical act, yeah, by that married couple for a while, I mean, we all know that, you know, the weight restrictions that you can take in space. Would they have had to have bothered taking contraception with them? Is it possible to get pregnant in space?
No, amazingly, we don't know the answer to that. Not for humans, not even for rodents. NASA has done a study where they had pregnant rats, and the rats, when they came down from space, gave birth, and there were even differences there in the number of contractions and things. They've flown semen, so they've flown bits and pieces of the whole process, but they have not actually had any kind of animals become pregnant in zero gravity. conceive in zero gravity. And that, to me, is kind of surprising, because it does seem to me that if the whole goal of the space program is to one day colonize other planets, we need to know if that's doable. Can people conceive in a reduced gravity environment? Is it possible? And it's not, it's an unknown. It's still an unknown.
And what about give birth as well? In some respects, you might think that might be easier.
Yeah, it was interesting that with the rodents, what happened is there weren't the same number of contractions. And you might say, well, yeah, that would be easier, like giving birth in water, there's water births. But I spoke to a woman who worked for NASA who'd done those rodent experiments, and she said, in fact, her belief was the contractions of birth are part of what kind of jump starts the body and gets it ready to make the big transition. And you need that rush of adrenaline, and you need the kind of the trauma of contraction to kind of kickstart the child and get all these processes going, breathing, all the different changes that happen from, you know, being in the womb and outside the womb. So she felt that that was a significant difference, and that maybe making it easier isn't the best thing for the baby. So even that isn't... Somebody has this... If you look in the U.S. patent website, someone came up with a centrifuge that would spin... It would spin the baby out. Like, so you would use the forces created by the centrifuge to kind of make it easier to get the baby out. So, not, I don't know about space, but somebody, like, the space training equipment, mm-hmm. the giant centrifuge arm has been, in theory...
And just lots of midwives with baseball mitts that are around the outside.
Yeah, exactly, ready to catch. Yes, this contraption had a little net to catch the baby as it was flung from between the woman's legs. It's quite an extraordinary contraption. But we don't know. We don't even know. And people have talked about, you know, why is that? Why has NASA not done that? Are they prudish and squeamish and misogynistic? And in fact, it's what I think it has, or what I've heard it has more to do with, is just it's a matter of priorities and the physiological systems NASA is looking at in terms of what's, you know, space exploration is how do we deal with radiation, safety issues? How do you deal with bone loss, muscle deterioration, making space safer for astronauts? And then once they figure that out, then we'll look at, you know, can we even think about colonizing other planets and things like that.
So you mentioned there's experiments on rats, and there's a long and sometimes ignoble tradition of animals going into space first before we send humans up. As interesting as rats are, I want to spend some time talking about chimps. So tell us first of all about the story of the various Alberts.
Yeah, the various Alberts. This is dating back to right after World War II, and the U.S. came into possession of its very first rockets, very exciting rockets, and they were, most of the military people were looking at them as, you know, the potential to launch something very far, very fast, a payload, a weapon, a bomb. But there was a group of scientists saying, hey, we could use these to launch a live organism into space for the first time, because we never have, and we don't know what happens up there. We don't know what that does to a live organism. Can a human being even survive? Well, let's start small. Let's start with, and they didn't start with monkeys. They started with, you know, much smaller creatures. But the monkeys, you know, it was very much a one thing at a time. You know, well, first we'll send, you know, some mold or, you know, something very, very, very basic, and we'll work our way up. The Alberts was a series, Albert 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, I think it went up to 6. Anyway, the Alberts were strapped to the nose cone, where the payload would be, where the bomb would be, little tiny rhesus macaques that went up, and it was a sad story. I mean, most of them didn't survive for various, not because of gravity, but for various malfunctions with the rockets, the launches, or recovery of the animal. They couldn't find them, basically. So, but they did learn that while they were up there, and they were sedated, they weren't conscious. They didn't know what was going on. Thankfully, they what they were looking at is vital signs. That there wasn't a lot you could really determine from just sort of putting the animal up there and having it come back down. But the vital signs seemed okay, and they were reassured that it did seem that there wasn't a catastrophic change in the organism, and that maybe we could send a higher primate. Then we move on to the chimp era. And the chimps were kind of the dress rehearsal for America's first people in space. And they, one of the things they were looking at with the chimps, and the astronauts, the Mercury astronauts were very much against sending up a dress rehearsal with a chimp. They're like, we're ready, send us up. But there was a concern that being weightless would somehow affect the nervous system, the brain, in a way that the astronaut wouldn't be able to do tasks. So these chimps were taught a very specific repertoire of lever pulling and pushing and tasks. They were looking at making sure they could still, their cognitive systems would still work. And also, the other thing going on, the chimp had to reach out and raise levers. There's certain, when you go up in space, there's a period, not where you're weightless, but where there's extra gravity when you're coming back down. And it's almost impossible to lift your arm. It weighs several times its normal weight on Earth. So they were interested in also, could the chimp reach out and push levers and do these simple things that an astronaut would have to be able to do. So they were two things they were looking at with the chimps. And just it was kind of, you know, crossing the T's and dotting the I's and making sure that the astronaut, there wasn't going to be this kind of catastrophic thing that had been overlooked when they sent them up into space. So the chimps, Ham being the most famous, Ham was the first to go. Enos actually orbited the Earth more. Enos did a much more newsworthy mission, but because he was second, he didn't get all the glory, and he wasn't as cute as Ham.
But also, he wasn't so much of a well-behaved poster boy.
No,
was he?
He wasn't the same poster boy. Ham was super cute, and Enos was an unattractive and really ornery chimp. Nobody liked Enos, and Enos got this horrible reputation as a masturbator. They called him. He had a nickname, Enos the Penis, and people assumed it's because he was a masturbator. In fact, Enos the Penis, I tracked down Enos's trainer, who's still alive, and I said, so this nickname, Enos the Penis, he said, yeah, we gave that to him because he was just such a little son of a gun. I said, you mean he was a dick? Yeah, that's why we called him Enos the Penis. I said, you mean he didn't have, you know, a habit of playing with himself? And he said, Mary, all chimps play with themselves. He said, no, that's not true. Who told you that about Enos? But there's this rumor, you look up any of a half dozen space histories from the time, they'll talk about Enos has had this habit, and he would, like, whip it out during press conferences and play with himself. And in fact, it's not true. Poor Enos. Enos was not. He wasn't a particularly pleasant chimpanzee, but he wasn't quite the naughty boy that people made him out to be.
Well, that's a perfect point to end a discussion of packing for Mars. If we can just briefly finish up, you've virtually finished another book. You've got another book coming out reasonably soon. I guess I'm expecting another one-word title to keep with the sequence. What's this new book going to be about?
Yeah, this one, the new one is called Gulp. GULP, and the subtitle, I'm not sure what the subtitle will be, but the working one right now is Adventures on the Alimentary Canal, and it's kind of an unusual, I have the table of contents here, let's see, I'll read you one. Chapter 8, Big Gulp, How to Survive Being Swallowed Alive. We have Inflammable You, Fun with Hydrogen and Methane. Eating Backwards is the Digestive Tract to Two-Way Street. Which is a really interesting. Never mind. Don't need to go into detail right now.
And when will we expect to see that published?
That should be early next year. Yeah.
Mary, it's been wonderful speaking to you again. Thanks for taking the time to talk.
Oh, I enjoyed it very much. Thanks for having me on.
I'm Sean Carroll. That was a Little Adams Road Trip podcast. The show is produced and presented by Neil Denny and was made possible by a traveling fellowship from the Winston Churchill Memorial Trust. Follow us on the trip on Twitter @LittleAdams, and thanks for listening.